It's Lynn Rossetto Casper with The Splendid Table. Today it's the man who could be New York's next star chef. Indian chef Suvir Saran creates clear, singing flavors, tastes of Indian home cooking. It's simpler and lighter than what we usually get in restaurants. His new restaurant is Devi. His book is Indian Home Cooking. Well, the Sterns are at Santa Fe's oldest eatery, dipping sopapillas into liquid sunshine. Our highly opinionated cheese man, Steve Jenkins, talks his cheeses of a lifetime. Then how a fragile mother-son relationship is forged in the kitchen from Britain's beloved food writer, Nigel Slater. And crack cook Sally Schneider checks out the sexy new winter squashes. All this and your calls coming up on The Splendid Table. But first, this.
ਉਹਨੂੰ ਕਹਿੰਦੇ ਹੋਰ ਬੋਲੀਆਂ ਪਾਵੇ ਨਾ ਜੱਗ ਚੰਦਰੇ ਤੋਂ ਨਜ਼ਰ ਲਵਾ ਕੁੜੀਆਂ ਦੇ ਦੰਦ ਗਿਣਦਾ ਜਿਹੜਾ ਨੱਚਦੀਆਂ ਕੁੜੀਆਂ ਦੇ ਲੱਕ ਮਿਣਦਾ ਜਿਹੜਾ ਹੱਸਦੀਆਂ ਕੁੜੀਆਂ ਦੇ ਦੰਦ ਗਿਣਦਾ ਹੋਣਾ ਸੋਹਣਾ ਜਿਹਾ ਉਹਦਾ ਕੋਈ ਨਾ ਨੀ ਭਾਬੀ ਮੈਨੂੰ ਦੱਸ ਪੁੱਛ ਕੇ ਨੀ ਭਾਬੀ ਮੈਨੂੰ ਦੱਸ ਪੁੱਛ ਕੇ ਨੀ ਭਾਬੀ ਮੈਨੂੰ ਦੱਸ ਪੁੱਛ ਕੇ
Hi, it's Lynn Rossetto Casper, and you're listening to The Splendid Table, the show for people who love to eat. Our program is produced by American Public Media and brought to you by Super Target. Well, today it's East Indian food through new eyes. It's a look at what home cooking is really about and what it's like growing up in India wanting to be a cook. Our guest is Suvir Saran. His book is Indian Home Cooking, A Fresh Approach to Indian Food. Well, Steve Jenkins, our favorite cheese expert, talks his all-time favorite cheeses. Now, you're going to need a spoon for this. Then it's Britain's beloved food writer and novelist, Nigel Slater. The kitchen is the pivot point of his memoir, Toast. It's the place where all the fragility of love and family is exposed. And as always, in the second half of the show, we're going to be opening the lines for your calls. Now, you can get to us at 800-537-5252. So let's get things rolling the way we do every week with Jane and Michael Stern, brought to you by Starbucks, a passion for the perfect cup. The Sterns write the Road Food column in Gourmet Magazine. Jane, Michael, you know, at this time of year with the fall leaves turning, everybody heads for New England. But for me, Santa Fe, I mean, is it not the most beautiful time of year to go there?
It is the most beautiful time to go, and it's also when the chili harvest is, and when you drive around the country roads around Santa Fe, you see those great roasters by the side of the road are just charring the red and green chilies.
And people have the ristras that are hanging in front of the white adobe farmhouses. Those
long
strings.
I tried to eat a ristra, and unfortunately, nobody told me it had been shellacked. I thought it had a kind of a strange taste.
For people who don't know what ristra is, it's all the chilies tied together. It's a great bunch of bright red chili that's set out to dry. And I think it means string, ristra. But for decoration purposes, sometimes they are shellacked and don't eat them.
It's kind of like eating an artificial Christmas wreath or something.
Where do you guys like to go in Santa Fe?
Oh, there are so many good places to eat in Santa Fe. But, you know, one of our favorites is, in fact, the oldest restaurant in Santa Fe. It's right on the plaza, one of the few places on the plaza that remains as it has been for decades. It's called the Plaza Cafe. It's been there since 1918.
Oh, yeah.
And it looks, you know, from the inside and outside, like just a regular old town cafe. And in some respects, that's what it is.
You know, it actually from the outside reminds me, and this is weird, I don't know why, but it reminds me of a New York coffee house. I mean, it's probably, I think Michael and I must have gone to Santa Fe 20 times before we even noticed this place because, you know, it doesn't have that kind of, you know, sexy Southwestern look
right,
with all the adobe and the, you know, the ristras and everything. It looks very, very plain. But let me tell you, Lynn, the food is phenomenal in there.
Well, in fact, I believe that the best sopapillas I've ever eaten are made at the Plaza Cafe. You get a bowl of green chili or red chili, and on the side, they every day starting at 11 o'clock, they're open for breakfast, but every day starting at 11 o'clock, you can order these sopapillas, you know, hot from the fry kettle, light as a feather, and absolutely delicious, served with, of course, honey on the side.
You should explain, guys, what a sopapilla is, though, because I think a lot of people haven't had this incredible experience.
No, a sopapilla is, it's a fry bread. I think it goes back to the Indians of that area. It's a small triangle of fried dough that puffs up and is almost lighter than air. It looks like it would float off the plate, and the best ones almost do.
Kind of like a hollow fritter, like a square hollow fritter.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And it sounds like dessert, but in fact it's eaten with the main course.
And the thing that's great about it is not only the taste, it's the texture, because there's a certain kind of just faint crispness, and you know, you bite into it, and it kind of like almost evaporates. It falls apart and evaporates. And then once you've bitten into it, you can pour a little honey inside, which is the sort of favorite condiment.
And the Plaza also just has a sensational red or green chili. And it comes in a bowl, and there's nothing better than taking the hot sopapillas and dipping them into the red chili or the green. In this case, I believe the red is hotter than the green.
Yeah, you never know. But at the Plaza, in our experience, the red is the really hot stuff, and green is moderately hot.
And the interesting thing in Santa Fe, and I have no doubt this is true at the Plaza, is that when you say red chili, you're not talking about beans and tomatoes.
Oh, no.
You're talking red chili, and that's it.
It really is just kind of a bowl of pureed, fresh, roasted red Mexican, well, not Mexican, excuse me, that's heresy, New Mexican chilies.
And in the fall, when these are freshly roasted, the flavor is indescribable. It's liquid sunshine. There is nothing like freshly roasted chilies.
This is the place to go when you can't get a reservation in New England.
Exactly. And also get pozole with pork and menudo. Yum, yum, yum.
Oh, gosh, yeah. Hey, guys, thank you.
Bye, Lynn.
Adios.
Sterns are the authors of that indispensable guide, Road Food. Now, they're here every week, but you can get their food finds anytime. Just go to the website, splendidtable.org. And while you're on the site, check out our weekly newsletter. It's called Weeknight Kitchen. It's brought to you by the farmers of Organic Valley. Now, every week we send you a new recipe. This week it is a dynamite main dish bread pudding, tomato goat cheese strata. We also send along shopping and technique tips. And thanks to those cows, it's free. You can register for it online, splendidtable.org. Cheese-obsessed Steve Jenkins is opinionated, restless, and blessed with a great palate. Put this all together, and in Steve's case, you get a cheese expert who has spent the last 25 years tracking down artisan cheeses. Very fine artisan cheeses. Steve is author of Steve Jenkins' Cheese Primer. Steve, good to see you.
Hi, Lynn. Great to be with you.
Steve, I've been thinking about this because you talk about cheeses from all over the world. But for you personally, if you had to pick one type of cheese that you had to live with for the rest of your life, what would it be?
I'm not hesitating to tell you it's gushy cheeses.
Oh, that technical, gushy cheeses, yeah. Technical description.
Technical. Yes.
Well, what kind of cheese are you talking about, actually?
The gushy cheeses are the ones that are so easy to serve in that you don't even need cutlery. They're gushy. You put them in a little crock, you cut up bread into shards, and you pick up the bread and you poke at the gushy cheese.
But when you say that, one of the things that comes to mind is something like brie.
Brie is on my list as being one of the gushy cheeses, but you got to understand, there's brie, and then there's brie. Real brie.
Yeah. Well,
comes from brie. Fake brie comes from a factory from anywhere, and they're as different as day and night. All our listeners have to do is say, I want the brie experience. So that means you got to find the brie that says Demaux, M-E-A-U-X, the capital city of the brie region.
Mm-hmm.
And it will always be made by a guy named Rouzaire, R-O-U-Z-A-I-R-E. And any assiduous cheese shop will handle real brie from brie. All you got to do is ask for it. Do not, under any circumstances, allow ordinary factory brie into your life. The flavor that you get from these real bries and real camemberts is so immense and so complex that I dare say it'll be some time before you ever serve a hard cheese again. But there are other gushy cheeses that I want our listeners to recognize and try and remember to ask for when they go to a good counter.
Okay, which one?
Specifically, the Rhone Valley has two great cow's milk cheeses that come in little discs about the size of a, oh, smaller than a hockey puck. And lately they're packing them in these adorable little terracotta crocks, which sort of proves out that, yes, we are gushy cheeses and you don't even need a knife. One is Saint Marcellin and the other is Saint Florentin. These are neighboring villages. They've been famous for these little gushy cow's milk cheeses for centuries, and they are so, so good, you can't even believe it. The rinds that are natural on them go right down the hatch with the interior cheese, so there's no rind to trim away. And they're sort of a blonde color and shiny because they're so gushy. And the flavor is so excruciatingly delicious. I'm beside myself when I'm thinking about it. We serve them constantly, my wife and I, and we take them every time we go over somebody's house, we take one. And everybody just cavels, which for those of you outside New York means go crazy for.
Yes, and make sounds, moans and groans. Yeah.
Exactly.
But
let me give you two more. I gotta give you a couple more.
All right, go.
Perail, P-E-R-A-I-L. This is the little disc of sheep's cheese that the Roquefort makers make for themselves. It's about a half an inch thick and about 3 inches in diameter. And it's the word Perail is sort of a patois for the word pierre, meaning rock, because this area of Aveyron is so rocky. They just sort of named this like a little flat stone that you would skim across a river. That's exactly what it is. You could hook your index finger around a Perail and hurl it. But if you did that, it's so gushy you'd end up with a blob of Perail in your hand rather than a skipping stone across a river. Oh, Extremadura. That gorgeous region that's on the Portuguese border, the part of Spain called Extremadura, produces what must be called the cheese of the decade. It's Torta del Casar, C-A-S-A-R. And what it is about a 2-inch thick disc that's about 6 inches across and wrapped with burlap, because if it wasn't wrapped with this burlap, it would just flow into a great big huge puddle. And what we do with Torta del Casar, that's made from raw sheep's milk from this area, is just skim off this gorgeous sort of deer antler velvet rind and then just stick spoons in it. And we just wooden spoons, because it's just sort of organic, and I love wooden spoons. And you just sort of spoon out this incredibly flavorful junket on the shards of bread. Torta del Casar, gotta be the cheese of the decade.
Steve, thank you.
Ooh, thank you.
Cheese authority Steve Jenkins is author of Steve Jenkins Cheese Primer. Now, Steve can be found behind the counters of Fairway Markets in New York, but you can find his gushy cheese picks on the website, splendidtable.org. Coming up, real Indian home cooking and a memoir in food from Britain's beloved columnist Nigel Slater. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. You're listening to The Splendid Table from American Public Media. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. This is The Splendid Table, the show about life's appetites. The Splendid Table is brought to you by Super Target, a grocery store and Target all in one, where guests can have their cake and a plate to eat it on, too. Find them online at target.com/supertarget. When my pal Kara raves about a restaurant, I listen. She is one of the pickiest food professionals I know, and she lives in New York City, where there's a lot to be picky about. So when she said, you have to meet this man from India, Suvir Saran, and taste his food, I did. And I promptly went over the moon. It was as though all the Indian food I had had before was slightly out of focus, blurry. Suvir's dishes were clear, brilliant. Well, he's put a lot of that down on paper. Suvir Saran's new book is Indian Home Cooking. Suvir, welcome.
Thank you, Lynn.
Suvir, where actually did you grow up in India?
I was born in New Delhi, which is in northern India.
Right.
We call it Delhi, but technically the term is New Delhi. It's pretty much like New York, a melting pot of cultures and cuisines and languages and religions and all kinds of things that make a culture both interesting and could also be polarizing.
Yeah.
It's a hotbed of every activity that happens in India.
Now, how did you learn to cook? Did you learn to cook at home?
Yes, I did. I hesitated for a minute because I think I'm still learning. And I learned from my our family chef, Panditji, and my mother, and my grandmoms and mothers of friends.
Was the kitchen a place that a young boy went? Or was it that...
Not really. I think it was a place where if you went, you were made fun of.
Uh-huh. You know, in the acknowledgments, you thank your father for telling you to do what you love despite cultural opinion. Was this the cultural opinion that he was referring to?
Exactly. You know, when I was finishing high school, Lynn, I wanted to be a doctor or a painter, two very different streams to go into.
Yeah.
And I came back home and I said, Dad, I only got into dental school and I don't want to be a dentist. He said, become a painter. And it was not the kind of thing people from our lot in life did in India. And he was very supportive. He said, if you won't do it, who will? Go do it.
So you were a painter before you were a professional cook?
You know, I've given up painting because I realized my hands had become obsolete for the art of design. The computer ruled. So quickly, food became the way in which I could be tactile and still create something.
Huh. You talk about home cooking in this book, but what is home cooking in India?
Lynn, it's about being fresh. It's about being honest. It's about being simple. And it's about feeding masses of people unexpectedly. And literally the last part, feeding masses of people unexpectedly, is what makes it simple, honest, and sincere, and drama-free, which doesn't translate into Indian restaurant food in America or in London.
So the restaurant food, that's not what people are eating at home?
Not at all. It's creamy and just so heavy. We enjoy it, but we would eat food like that perhaps two or three times a year for a special party or an occasion.
Is there a series of basic steps that most of the dishes require?
You know, I would love to lie and say there is. But so that my cuisine, my country's cuisine can be fancified, but there isn't. I think the main step or the only one little thing that we need to learn about are spices. And when I say little, they're not because there's so many of them.
Right.
But I think the key to Indian food is in what I call entertaining spices. It's like a relationship between two human beings. You have to learn to understand each other, respect one another, cultivate one another, and most importantly, realize that there's this unspoken tension between two things.
Uh-huh.
And to master it, you have to really give of yourself to get from the other. And when I say that, people laugh that he's just speaking some kind of hippie baloney. But the reality is that, you know, spices are very forgiving, but if you burn them or undercook them or don't use enough or use the wrong ones, your food won't taste good. So what I tell people is to learn from a recipe or two and then understand what happens to the spices. And once you've made them your friend, you can create anything you want to.
You know, there's a collection of dishes in the book that I've not seen before. And they look so good. They're called rasams. And I'm not sure if I'm pronouncing it correctly.
Perfectly.
Okay. Could you explain what they are?
Rasam is a South Indian soup. And it's more like a consomme, Lynn. It's very runny, watery.
Right.
And in southern India, which is a hot, hot, they say the only three climates they have are hot, hotter, hottest. And when you go into these hot, sultry, humid homes, the first thing you get is a hot stainless steel glass of this soup that's bursting with steam. And it's nothing but just water that's been spiced. And traditionally, some are cooked with lentils, the water that you cook the lentils in, mm-hmm. and the others are made just with plain water. And this first taste of hot spices opens up your palate. It starts making you sweat, so the sweat cools you off. And it also initiates your palate to get ready for the next few courses that follow.
You know, seductive, I think, is just the right word for them. Thank you, Suvir.
Thank you, Lynn.
Indian Food Authority Suvir Saran's new restaurant is Devi in New York City. His book is Indian Home Cooking, A Fresh Introduction to Indian Food. Now, you can get Suvir's recipe for one of those quick soups, tomato rasam, on the website, splendidtable.org. Mention Nigel Slater's name in England, and you'll hear about his award-winning food writing, TV shows, and about his latest book, a memoir. It's called Toast, The Story of a Boy's Hunger. Nigel grew up in the 60s, a fragile boy with an ambitious palate. He grew up in a household that, well, let's say it was a far cry from the Cleavers.
A great deal was made of my being tucked in at night. "I'll come up and tuck you in," was as near as my mother ever got to playing with me. Tucking me in was her substitute for playing ball, going to the park to play on the slide, being there on sports day, playing hide and seek, baking cakes, giving me chocolate kisses, ice cream, toffee apples, making masks, and carving Halloween pumpkins. "I'll come up and tuck you in" was fine. It's when she forgot that it wasn't. Every few weeks, my mother and I would make jam tarts. She had small hands with long, delicate fingers, gentle, like her name, Kathleen. They say there was some Irish blood in her somewhere, but, like my mother's asthma, no one ever spoke of it. She would weigh the flour, the butter, the bit of lard that made the pastry so crumbly, and let me rub them all together with my fingertips in the big cream mixing bowl. We took the steel cookie cutters, rusty, dusty, and cut out rings of pastry, and pushed them into the shallow hollows of an even rustier patty tin. Mother didn't like cooking. She did this for me. When she met my father, she was working as a secretary to the mayor in the town hall, and had never made so much as a sandwich. She fell pregnant with me 15 years after my brother Adrian was born, and 5 years after they adopted his school friend, John. That's when the asthma came on, when she was expecting me. There had to be 3 different jams in the tarts, strawberry, blackcurrant, and lemon curd. I put a couple of spoonfuls of jam into each pastry case, not so much that they would boil over and stick to the tin, but enough that there was more jam than pastry. My father loved a jam tart, and would put one in whole and swallow it like a snake devouring a bird's egg. The tarts went in the top oven of the Aga, until the edges of the pastry cases turned the pale beige of a Lincoln biscuit, and the jam had caramelised around the edges. As the kitchen became hotter and more airless, my mother would take her inhaler from the top drawer and take long, deep puffs, turning her face away as she did so. Sometimes she would hold her hand to her chest and close her eyes for a few seconds in which the world seemed to stop. One day my father came home from work, and even before he'd taken off his coat, he grabbed one of our jam tarts from the wire cooling rack. He couldn't have known they'd come from the oven only a minute or two before. His hands flapped, his face turned a deep raspberry red, beads of sweat formed like warts on his brow. He danced a merry dance. As he tried to swallow, and his eyes filled with the sort of tears a man can only summon when he has boiling lemon curd stuck to the roof of his mouth, I'm sure I saw the faintest of smiles flicker across my mother's face. Mother was desperate to be a homemaker, a woman capable of sewing on a button, darning a sock, or icing a fairy cake. In the early evening, sitting under the standard lamp in the lounge, head tilted and the tip of her tongue pinched between her lips, she spent what seemed like hours trying to thread white cotton through the eye of a needle. "Let me do it," was met with a sigh, and "I've nearly done it now." Try as she might, buttons popped off within a day or two, toes poked through neat but ineffective repairs, icing pooled into the craters of her cakes, or, on the rare occasion they rose, ran down the sides in rivulets and stuck the flowery paper cases to the plate. Mrs. Poole made the beds, fed the winsette sheets through the ironing machine with its long, cotton-covered rollers, and would sew a stray button onto my school shirt. Mother made up for this humiliation by making rice pudding. Warm, milky rice. Rice that never thickened the sweet liquid it floated in. So what should have been a creamy spoonful, the texture of risotto, had to be sipped like broth. The skin browned and puffed into a blackened gilt dome. The kitchen smelled like a kitchen should. The skin was removed in one perfect scoop and deposited into my father's bowl. "It's the best bit," he used to say. Then the round rice was fished up from the depths and divided between us all. Then she would pick up the enamel tin and spoon out the milk. "Anyone for jam?" she would say, passing around the heartless strawberry. I was the only taker, stirring the sweet glop into the milk, then regretting it when it stayed in blobs and sank to the bottom of the dish. Milky, milky rice is considered a failure by rice pudding aficionados, yet I preferred it to her occasional successes. Warm, sweet milk was what a mother should smell of.
British food writer and novelist Nigel Slater is author of the award-winning memoir, Toast, The Story of a Boy's Hunger. Food authority Sally Schneider is one of the best cooks I know. She does things so easily and they always taste great. But her real genius is in how she streamlines dishes. Her book is A New Way to Cook. Sally, it is good to have you back with us.
Good to be here, Lynn. Thanks.
Sally, what do you do with Halloween pumpkins?
You know, Lynn, I just look at them. I don't eat them because their flavor just is not great. Although they look like they would be great, they're not. But what they are is a sign that their delicious cousins are around, and those are winter squashes in their season.
So you leave them to the jack-o'-lantern and you go to the
exactly.
rest of the family. Okay.
Exactly.
But when you say winter squash, there's a lot of new stuff out there. And I think it's kind of confusing because, I mean, there's all kinds of Japanese squashes and then there's the old standbys. What are your favorites?
Well, you're absolutely right. There are about 20 varieties at any given time in my farmer's market. The most commonly available are butternut, which I think is a very good bottom line standard squash. I love the striated sweet dumpling squashes, which are very small, which you can just slice and roast. And then the real favorites I have are the kabochas, which are Japanese squashes, which I found in my supermarket, especially the green ones. They have a velvety, creamy, extraordinarily delicious kind of vanilla flavor and texture. Also delicatas and buttercups. You'll find a little slightly hint of chestnut flavor in buttercups. They're all of the same kind of ilk. They have an orange or yellow flesh. They tend to be creamy. They tend to be sweet and somewhat spicy. But then, like wine grapes, they vary from one to the other.
So are there basic ways that you like to cook with them?
Yes, although you can microwave them or steam them or do any of that, my far and away favorite way to cook them is to roast them. The reason I do this is because roasting evaporates any moisture in the squash, and that can be a variable, and you don't want to have a watery squash.
Mm-hmm.
It intensifies the flavors, and it caramelizes their abundant sugar slightly, so you get this kind of chewy edge, and it develops that sort of brown sugar flavor in them, which I adore.
It's almost like they're a replacement for the sweet potato, isn't it?
Absolutely. In fact, you can use them interchangeably. Squashes, I find, have more nuance of flavor, and that's why I like them. You can also, of course, peel them and cut them into cubes if you just want to add them to soup or a risotto or something like that. Or you can roast the cubes so you have, again, that caramelized flavor and then throw them into those kinds of dishes.
Do you have sort of favorite seasonings that you like with them?
You know, squashes are so versatile and go with so many foods, and especially the autumn meats like duck venison, pork and turkey, and all of that. But I've roughly divided them into two camps. One is the warm sweet spice flavors that are so marvelous in pumpkin pie, cinnamon, cracked coriander, nutmeg, that sort of thing.
Mm-hmm.
By association, exotic spice mixes like curry and garam masala. And then I've developed even a Tunisian-inspired flavoring of ground coriander, paprika, and cumin. You know, so that's one ilk. The other set of flavorings are really what I consider to be kind of Mediterranean and European. That is garlic and caramelized shallots in league with herbs, especially sage and basil. Brown butter, pancetta, bacon, and the full-flavored cheeses like Parmigiano and Gruyere all love squashes. So there's an immense range of improvisation you can do.
Oh, I'm picturing a gratin. Hey, Sally.
Exactly.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Sally Schneider is author of A New Way to Cook. Now, you can start experimenting with those squash right now. Check out Sally's recipe for roasted winter squash slices on the website, splendidtable.org. Well, it's time for our weekly trivia challenge. We're having a bit of a religious moment here. Now, the question is, in statues and paintings of the Madonna, what is the only food you would ever find in her hand? We're going to have that answer in a moment, and we're going to be opening the lines for your calls. You can reach us at 800-537-5252. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. You're listening to The Splendid Table from American Public Media. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper, and this is The Splendid Table, the show for people who love to eat. The Splendid Table is brought to you by Super Target, one-stop shopping for groceries, cookware, and entertaining. You can visit them online at target.com/supertarget. Now, we're going to be opening the lines for your calls in a moment. The number is 800-537-5252. But first, I have got the answer to this week's trivia challenge. Now, as I said, we were having a bit of a religious moment. The question was, in statues and paintings of the Madonna, what is the only food you might ever see in her hand? Well, the food is the pomegranate, the red fruit filled with shiny garnet-colored seeds. It's sweet, tart, kind of reminds you of cherries. You'll occasionally see it in the hands of the Madonna. Now, one of the most famous Madonna pomegranate works is by Botticelli. He painted his Madonna of the Pomegranate in 1487. Now, if you look closely, you'll realize that there's something of a mystery in the painting. Botticelli didn't pick his visuals just because they were pretty. Each element had a message. Mary is sitting, and around her are six angels. Two have lilies, one has roses. The baby Jesus is in her lap, and Mary is holding a cut pomegranate. The baby has just grabbed it, too. Now for the messages. The lily symbolizes purity, the rose, peace, and everlasting love, and the pomegranate, at least in this case, means the resurrection, the link between life and death. Now, this wasn't anything new for people in Botticelli's time. They read paintings the way we read comic books. They probably knew that the ancient Egyptians believed that pomegranates really were a link between now and the afterlife. In fact, they buried them in their tombs in the pyramids. For many, the pomegranate with its gem-like seeds symbolized the seventh day of the creation and the seven pillars of wisdom. And they were eaten on Jewish high holy days. And then there's the obvious. All those seeds mean fertility or wealth. Not bad for a fruit you can find in the supermarket. The lines are officially open. You can reach us at 800-537-5252, and we will talk. Okay, let's see who has been waiting patiently. We've got Trent on the line from Seattle. Hey, Trent, what's up?
Well, today, Lynn, I'd love to talk about prickly pear cactus leaves.
Prickly pear? Oh, okay, okay. Do you work with them? Do you like them? Do you eat them?
You know, I see them in the store all the time, and although they don't grow native around here, we seem to have them in every store, and I told my girlfriend I would love to prepare them, but I haven't a clue how to do them. I'm afraid I'd end up with a mouth of quills.
And it's possible, trust me. Well, okay, I'm rolling back my mind to Rick Bayless's advice, because I've only worked with them once or twice. One of the things you do is you work with gloves.
Okay, sounds like a good start.
Yeah,
chain
good
start. Mail or?
Well, no, not chain of mail, but you want some pretty, you know, you want heavy plastic gloves would be a good idea. A lot of what is sold commercially are called spineless cactuses, but they really do still have some pricklies in them.
Okay.
And one of the things that you do is you want a medium-sized paddle. You know, that's what I think you call that.
Would medium be about the size of my palm or my hand?
I think that size or a tad smaller.
Okay.
And you trim the outside, you trim the perimeter a bit because there are a lot of spines there. There generally are. And then you can just cut away the other spines. And you're doing this by holding it with your rubber gloves or your plastic gloves. At that point, you treat this, I want to say the way you might treat a very thin sliced potato, okay? You can grill it, which is fabulous. Absolutely fabulous. You can roast it, and all you need is a little bit of fat, like a tad of olive oil and salt and pepper. But one of the main wonderful things you can do with it is you roast it on the grill, or you grill it under the broiler, or, you know, on top of the stove, however you want to do it.
Like a direct heat, then, not indirect?
Not indirect,
okay.
No. And then what you do is you cut it up and you toss it with a really fresh, let's say, serrano chili, tomato, lime juice, avocado kind of salsa.
Okay.
And if you want, throw in a few chunks of jicama, because jicama is sweet and crisp.
Now, I have tried that, yes.
But make the main ingredient, the bulk of the ingredient, is the cut up grilled or roasted cactus paddles. They're called nopales. It's fabulous because they have this meaty, I think, sweet green taste. You know, they don't have a strong flavor, but it's a very nice taste.
Okay.
And it tends to act as this lovely base for these other things. So that's one thing you could do.
Okay.
Okay?
Well, I appreciate that, Lynn. And I will try this recipe this week. So thank you very much.
You are welcome, Trent. Take care.
Have a good day.
You too. You can call us, guys. 800-537-5252. We've got Forrest on the line calling from St. Louis. Hey, Forrest, what's up?
Hey, how are you?
I am great. What do you want to talk about?
I am trying to make tamales. and I've tried twice, and they turned out okay, but not as well as I'd like. And I'm curious about the best way to roll them up and what to wrap them in and the best way to cook them. It's just, it's a challenge, and it's nothing that anyone in my family could teach me.
Well, yeah, I know what you mean. Were you steaming them, right?
Yeah, I've done two methods. I've done one in a steamer where I actually used just a, you know, basic electric steamer, and then the other I just put them actually in a stock pot.
Okay. Do you have access to a Mexican market?
I actually live one block from a wonderful international grocery store in St. Louis.
Oh.
And so I've bought masa.
Right.
And I've mixed it up, and I think they add for some shortening with it as well.
Right, yes, because that's lovely. It's delicious with that. Yeah.
And I also bought the dried corn husks.
Yeah,
which
and you
I've separated
soak
and soaked, and
right.
They end up in various sizes.
Right, of course. But and you overlap them, you know, to get a rectangle, essentially, that is about, I'm just looking at with my hands now, a rectangle that's probably about 4 to 5 inches wide and,
right.
And maybe 6 inches long. But then you have the tail, you know, the end of the corn husk.
Right.
It's sort of like a long triangle.
And one of the hardest parts for me, I think, is how to spread it out and keep it even and roll everything up.
Okay. The deal is you put the corn husks into hot water and you let them sit for about an hour. You pull them out. You pat them dry. You put them onto your counter and you kind of overlap them a little bit.
Huh.
So that you get a pretty solid, you know, like two pieces of corn husk or three, rectangle, which will have those tails, you know, the little triangular pieces.
Oh.
And then in the middle of that, you put your masa, okay? But just a few, like a quarter of a cup of it. Not a ton. And you can do that with a spoon or you can do it with your fingers. Always have your fingers wet. It just makes it easier because, you know, masa can be like sticky paste.
Mm-hmm.
And then you put a filling, whatever it is, the pork with the chili, you know, the seasoned vegetables, whatever it might be, in the center there. Just put it on top. And then you roll up, you bring the two sides of your husks together and overlap them and snug them up a bit.
Okay. And are you using one husk?
No, I'm using two.
And
I'm overlapping because sometimes with one husk, it's just not going to work.
Right.
Later on when we get to, you know, Tamales 202, we can do the one husk. But for me, I want an insurance policy. And you bring the long sides together and overlap them as you tuck in the left and the right flaps, so to speak. And then the other trick, and I learned this from Rick Bayless, who describes this process in his books brilliantly, is you use one of those collapsible vegetable steamer things that you can put in any size pot.
Oh, yeah. Uh-huh. That's what I used last time.
Yeah. And the idea is you want the tamales standing up.
Right.
So he uses bunches of aluminum foil to steady them.
Oh.
Which is great because whenever I would try to stand mine up, either they were so tight they didn't cook right.
Right.
Or, you know, they just...
And if you didn't make a batch that filled the pot, then
you were in a mess.
Is.
Yeah, and they do freeze, by the way, brilliantly.
And that's what I've done too. They're great from the freezer.
Yeah, fabulous from the freezer. But the point is that if you use bunches of foil like braces, you know, you're fine. You have blocks that you can lean them against, and then you steam for about an hour. And you may have to add boiling water occasionally down the side of the pot, but you steam for about an hour. And that should do it for you.
Well, that's perfect. I will experiment, and I just think it's going to take more practice.
They do take practice, you know. They but once you nail it, you're going to remember it, and then you can start fooling around, like putting fresh corn with the masa and herbs and, you know, that kind of thing. But that's the basic idea of it.
Wonderful. Thank you so much.
Hey, enjoy.
Okay.
You take care.
You too. Bye.
Great party food. As I said, once you nail the tamale, and the tamale, by the way, it's the Tom Sawyer method of getting work done. You bring in all your friends and you have all the ingredients lined up and you've got the corn husks laid out and everybody, give them wine, plenty of wine, and they'll make you tamales and you'll have a party. Well, you can reach us 800-537-5252. We have Emily on the line from Columbus, Ohio. Hey, Emily, what's up? What
Hi.
Do you want to talk about?
Well, my husband and I went to Italy 4 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
And our first night there when we were still kind of, you know, shell-shocked from the flight, we found a teeny tiny little trattoria with maybe four tables, all Romans around us, it looked. And we had this fantastic vegetable dish. And I know there were eggplants and zucchini. I'm not sure what other types, but they were wonderful. They were, I don't know for sure if they were roasted or they were sautéed in olive oil. But I've been trying to reconstruct it, and I can't. I've tried just sautéing in olive oil, and the eggplant soaks up so much oil that they just get soggy.
Was it stew-like, or was it like roasted vegetables in the sense that they're kind of separate from each other and they're not throwing off a lot of juice?
Separate from each other.
Yeah.
It was served on a platter.
Uh-huh.
A little prosciutto on the side.
Okay, so I'm just thinking, because, you know, the simplest dishes are the hardest ones to duplicate.
Yes.
First of all, you need pristinely fresh vegetables.
Yes.
And that's probably what, you know, whatever was in season at the time was probably what ended up on your plate.
It was August, I'm not sure.
So, well, it would be, yeah, that would then definitely be eggplant, pepper, tomato, you know, I mean, mm-hmm. Think about what we have in season in August. What you want to do, and what kind of olive oil are you using?
Extra virgin.
Okay. Are you using one that if you had to drink it from a glass, you'd love it?
Oh, no, I'm not.
Okay. That's your key.
Okay.
Yeah, that's your key. I'll bet you what was done with these things was they were cut up, they were tossed with a little bit of olive oil and some salt and pepper and maybe garlic, and they were roasted in an oven, I'm just thinking basic roast, about 400 degrees, but in a shallow pan.
Okay.
And spread out. They weren't piled one on top of another.
Okay.
And they were allowed to really get nice and brown. They were turned, you know, fairly frequently and get really nice and brown. Don't burn them, but you want them brown because that's where people get scared. You know, they think that, oh, my gosh.
Right.
And then what you would do is you would put them on the platter and you'd sprinkle them with a dynamite tasting olive oil.
Oh.
And you would cook them with that oil, too. But you don't drown them in the oil in the cooking process. You do the olive oil as a finishing seasoning. And obviously a generous amount of salt and pepper. And just, I mean, there are a couple of olive oils out there that I can think that you can find, I think, around the country. One is Olio Verde, V-E-R-D-E. Mm-hmm. And it's in a rectangular bottle, a clear glass. And the other one is from California. It's called McEvoy.
McEvoy.
Yeah, McEvoy. And another one from Italy is Capizana, C-A-P-P, I think A-Z-A-N-A, something like that. You want them to tell you when they were pressed. It has to say on the bottle the year it was pressed. And at this time of year, it should have been pressed last fall.
Okay.
Or into the winter. So you want 2003, but nothing from 2002.
Oh, why is that?
Because after a year, olive oil starts to fade and lose its flavor. And what I'm telling you about is going to cost you a fortune. And if you're going to spend a fortune, you better get something really great.
Right, definitely.
Yeah. Okay? So try that. It's going to be an investment. Keep the oil in a dark place. Keep it cool. You'll have it for another 6 months or a year. It'll be great.
Dark place and cool. Okay. Wonderful.
Enjoy.
Thank you. I will.
You take care.
Bye-bye.
Goodbye. You can reach us, guys, 800-537-5252. Save the great tasting olive oil for sprinkling on stuff once it's out of the pan, out of the oven, etc. So you get the real full flavor of the oil. To really stay on top of the very latest food trends, you cannot focus solely on both coasts. You have to have eyes everywhere, especially in little towns in Wisconsin, like Richland Center. Places like this are hotbeds for culinary iconoclasts. Well, we have one of them on the phone. Ben Fournier is co-owner of Fox's Pizza Den in Richland Center. Ben, welcome.
Nice to be speaking here today.
Ben, tell me about your latest creation.
Well, for the month of October, we're kind of having a Norwegian feast, you might say.
Uh-huh.
And this includes lutefisk pizza, pickled herring breadsticks, and cinnamon sugar lefse for dessert.
This is pizza now you're talking about.
Yes, it is. It's hasn't been tried before, as far as we know.
I wonder why.
it's not for the faint of heart, that's for sure.
Could, you know, there are people out there, believe it or not, who don't know what lutefisk is. Could you explain it?
Yeah, lutefisk, it's a Norwegian tradition. It's it's essentially codfish. It's dried over in Norway. It's, mm-hmm. it's caught, processed, and dried. They bring it back to the United States, and they kind of reconstitute it, let's say. And while most of them nowadays are using a caustic soda blend to kind of reconstitute the fish, We're actually going with a supplier who still uses the old Lewis lye, the old-fashioned traditional way. And they soak these fish fillets for about 20 days. Oh. And it creates kind of a, for lack of a better term, a gelatinous fish.
So tell me, what does this pizza look like?
It actually looks like a fairly, well, it's not a very traditional pizza. When we did the menu testing for this, we tried a few different sauces in that, different marinara sauces and butter blends. What we found complemented the fish the best actually was a garlic butter sauce instead of our regular tomato-based marinara sauce.
Sort of a lutefisk scampi. I like this.
Exactly.
This is great. So, all right, the big question is, have you had any takers?
We actually have. We the first day we offered it, that was the very first order of the day. It was a large lutefisk pizza for a delivery, and I didn't hear back on that one. But later on in the day, we had two very sweet old Norwegian ladies come in and ordered the entire meal, the pickled herring breadsticks, lutefisk pizza, and the lefse. And as a new restaurant owner, I was scared out of my wits because it was readily apparent that these people knew their lutefisk.
And did they like it?
I went back 15 minutes later to their table. They said, "This is excellent. We've really... we've captured the essence well, I guess."
Well, Ben, thanks for talking with us. Congratulations. I think I'm safely going to say that you are doing something right now that is truly unique.
Excellent. Thank you very much.
You take care.
Yep, you too, though.
Bye.
Bye-bye.
Ben Fournier is co-owner of Fox's Pizza Den in Richland Center, Wisconsin. Now, they're going to be serving lutefisk pizza with pickled herring breadsticks and cinnamon sugar lefse all through the month of October. Well, that's the show for this week, guys. Thanks for joining us. Remember, you can call us anytime. The number is 800-537-5252. And until next week, let me leave you with this. Every year, the Washington Post has a competition for alternate word meanings. Now, the original word is gargoyle. The alternate meaning is an olive-flavored mouthwash. The Splendid Table is brought to you by SuperTarget. Everything you heard here today and so much more can be found on our website, splendidtable.org. Our email newsletter, Weeknight Kitchen, is made possible by Organic Valley, an independent cooperative of family farmers bringing fresh milk, juice, butter, eggs, and cream to your local supermarket every day. More information available online at organicvalley.com. Additional support for our program comes from Starbucks, from coffee farmer to their roasters to your barista. Craft, creativity, and passion are poured into every cup. Our producer is Sally Swift with help from Jennifer Russell. Our technical director is Jennifer Lubke. Our website is managed by Judy Graham and Julia Schrankler. Have a great week. Join us next time. Thanks for tuning in. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper.
American Public Media.